They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you two mine?
And welcome to the Baker Street Babes podcast, episode number 13, Undershaw. Today I'm very, very happy to have Lynn Gale and Alistair Duncan, who are both forerunners for the Undershaw Preservation Trust and saving the former house of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So, hello, everybody.
Hi.
Hello.
Today, we have babes Curly, Artie, and Marie is finally on a podcast. Yay.
Hello.
Like I said, we have Lynn Gale and Alistair Duncan. So, thank you so much for agreeing to be on. Obviously, saving Undershaw is huge, and we've supported it from its moment I know that I heard about it when I went to Undershaw Day in Hindhead, which was so much fun.
Indeed.
To get you started, you have to become honorary Baker Street Babes. So I know you're
that
really
might be more difficult for me.
Well, I think for me as well.
I don't see what you're talking about.
I guess we'll proceed alphabetically. So, Alistair, first off, hi, we've been tweeting for like ever, and I'm so glad to finally get to talk to you.
I know, I'm a technophobe, isn't I? I make it very difficult, didn't I? Right,
so I guess for your introduction, how did you first hear about Sherlock Holmes?
Ooh, right. Reaching into my dim and distant past, we are talking 1982, and a bout of what I think was either chickenpox or flu that led to me being stuck in the house, dragging my weary body down to the lounge one day and finding my mother watching The Scarlet Claw, and it all started there.
So, who's your favourite character from the canon, then?
From the canon in general, or from that particular film?
Both.
Typical, I walked right into that, didn't I? Well, from the canon, aside from Holmes himself, I think one of my favourite characters has to be Mycroft. From that particular film, probably the Postman Potts.
Oh, very cool. That's not one that we hear very often, so why that particular story?
Well, just that particular film, because that was obviously the first one I saw. It's what started me off, so it always has a sort of a little place in my heart there somewhere, because it's entirely responsible for all that's now taken place. Well, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you lovely ladies with four books behind me and God knows what else on my record if I hadn't a film in 1982.
Yay. So I guess that sort of takes just favorite story question then. What's your favorite adaptation? Because I know that you were originally on Team BBC Sherlock for the debate, but then you switched to the traditionalists. So would you say that the Granada adaptation is your favorite adaptation?
Definitely, without a doubt. I actually think it was very cruel when there was the sudden introduction of Team 3 forcing me to make a choice.
I agree.
Because it wasn't really much of a choice, because once they were there, I had to go, really. But I felt like a little bit of a traitor, I suppose, for having argued so passionately in favour of it, to have to turn around and sort of gesture at it with my fingers and walk off to the traditional camp.
I think we did. We did pretty well.
Yeah. It was rigged from the very start.
I know. It was like we went in. It's like, oh, it's been fun. I was sorry that you were ill. You couldn't be there.
Well, I mean, I doubt if I'd been fit that I might not have got into it anyway.
Well, thank you. And Lynn, same questions to you. How did you first get into Sherlock Holmes?
You're mean to me. You really are. I'm fairly new to the whole canon. It wasn't until I got myself involved with Undershaw, really, towards the end of 2008, when I drove past Undershaw and realised it was up for sale. Obviously, I knew all about Sherlock Holmes, but Arthur Conan Doyle, I didn't know anything about, believe it or not. And it's sad, really. It's that I've come to sort of like, obviously, you know, be enthusiastic with Conan Doyle. I love the history. I love all about the sort of Victorian era. So yes, I'm very late in life in liking sort of Sherlock Holmes. So it's sad.
No, it's fine. Everyone finds it different ways.
So I really don't know much about it. But obviously, I'm going through the book very slowly. So yes, I've got a lot to learn.
Do you have a favourite story that you've read so far?
Well, it's got to be, of course, The Hound of the Baskervilles. but then I'm working on my second story now, believe it or not, and that's Alistair's new book. So, Alistair, I promise you, I am reading it.
Lynn, it doesn't send out good vibes for selling this book if you admit you can't get into it.
I'm just a busy, busy person, as you could all appreciate.
I'll spare you some of the more specific questions, Lynn, but what's your favourite adaptation so far? Have you seen any?
Yes, I have, yeah. It's got to be the Granada series, shamefully, I must say, although basically because I do love the Victorian era, so it's got to be Granada.
There's no shame in saying that.
No, there's not, I know, but there you go.
Well, thank you. You're now honorary Baker Street Babes.
Thank you very much.
You're causing me an identity crush.
Alistair Duncan, Baker Street Babe.
I'll add it to my list of other qualifications.
There you go. Put it on your CV.
It suits you, Alistair.
I might just abbreviate it to BSB, though. Then that might be easier.
It'll sound very official and fancy, then. It's like, oh, what's that? It's like, oh, well, it's very exclusive. You can't see it.
You stay mysterious. It's all in the mystery. It's good.
Well, one tries, one's best.
So, obviously, Undershaw is one of the houses of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the only one left standing, and it's barely standing at that. But I guess...
Well, actually, that's not entirely true, but it's the only one that's sort of available, as
right,
it were.
Right.
And, of course, the only one he designed, or helped
well, that
design.
Is true.
Yeah, so extremely chiefly Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's, for sure. I suppose... For those who don't know or aren't as clear, could you explain sort of what's happening? Sort of explain what the trust is all about, if you could.
Right, okay. Well, John Gibson formed us back in the summer of 2009, basically because he wanted to give us a name to promote very iconic and valuable building. And obviously, just going by our names, we felt that perhaps... we wouldn't get noticed and we wouldn't get the publicity that we really needed to save the building. So that's why we were formed. A lot of people probably think, you know, the Undershaw Preservation Trust, they must have money. Unfortunately, we don't. I wish we had, and then obviously we could do something about it, but we are sort of basically a name, and, you know, hopefully a name that will be noticed. And I believe since we formed, we have actually got that notice that we so desperately needed. And that's, of course, thanks to all the reps that we have around the world.
Catherine says hello, by the way. She's in China, and it's very late, so she can't be here.
Oh, bless her. Okay, please say hello back when you have the chance.
I know. Like, I know this, but for people who don't. What's the chief aim of the trust? Like, why? Because I know there's all these ordinances and all this ridiculous stuff that's happening, and sort of the fight that's going on to sort of save it from being, like, split up and everything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, our main aim would be to save it as a working centre. For authors, and obviously have part of it as a museum, part of it as tea and coffee rooms, and have it used as a working centre to tie in with the Hilltop Writers here in Hindhead, Surrey. It's massive to think of that, especially the way the actual council has been treating the property. So ideally, then, our second aim would be to prevent it from being split into three separate houses. Once that happens, obviously, and may I add that once it is split up, it will be split with block concrete walls from floor to ceiling. So there's no going back once it's divided into three. There'll be no going back. But if we can keep it as one main property, we could have then all options left open for the future. And perhaps then if we still fight on, we could maybe have enough funds maybe at the end of the day, if we decide to register as a charity, to go forward and maybe purchase the property. But our ultimate aim is to prevent the developers from dividing it up.
Yeah, irks me greatly.
Well, I've been there as well. I mean, we went there for during the day to take pictures and take a look and see how it was. And it was just heartbreaking to see the state of the house. And it's such a brilliant space. And there could be so much stuff done, and even in terms of charity, you know, taking people there. Mm-hmm. So it's really heartbreaking to see as it is right now. And that's why we need to talk about it.
I don't know whether you felt the same, Marie, but each time I go down to the property, and I do this several times a month, I feel like it's keeper, really, that I can feel the history. It's just such a sort of a building that just oozes the history of Conan Doyle and his many literary friends that he entertained there. It's just so annoying that there's nobody out there that, you know, is willing to sort of come forward. I know it's economic crisis everywhere, which is the sad thing, and probably we've formed at a very difficult time, really. But there's no excuse. There is no excuse for Waverley Borough Council, and this is where I'm beginning to get annoyed, as you do, to allow it to fall into such disrepair. I mean, it's a Grade II listed building, and it should be protected by the local council.
Yeah, no, it's in horrible, horrible shape. Because when I saw it, like, maybe it won't be that bad. And then you get there, and it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's falling apart, literally.
It really
but
is.
I mean, I've had the opportunity when I was in my early 20s to actually go into Undershaw when it was a hotel. And, of course, then I suppose I didn't appreciate what it stood for or what it was. So, you know, at that sort of age, going for a boozy night, staggered up the long driveway and never been back since until the end of 2008. And I live relatively close to the property. So I feel a little bit of anger, I suppose, of myself that I hadn't done a lot more within that property as far as visiting it and going for a meal more times than what I did, you know, then. So yeah, it's heartbreaking.
It is.
I suppose a little bit switch gears. So, Alistair, when you decided to write this book, was it like after you had been to the house, or is it before, or what sort of spurned you?
I think Lynn's probably quaking in her boots at what I'm going to say at this point.
Oh dear.
No, really, it all started at the beginning of 2010 when I became aware of Undershaw's plight, and it was being advertised at the time by an organisation that I think Lynn will be familiar with called Hindhead Together. And I think their principal aim was to sort of re-energise Hindhead's businesses in general. And Undershaw was just one of many things they'd highlighted that could contribute to that. So I contacted them initially and tried to get involved, but it became apparent to me very quickly that they weren't all that interested in me because I lacked the two things that they really wanted, which was people with business acumen and lots of spare cash. I fell into neither category. So I swiftly dropped off their radar. But I'm pretty sure that in one of their last communications, they mentioned the Undershaw Preservation Trust. And towards the end of March of 2010, I got in touch with Lynn, and it all started from there. So it was long before I saw the house.
Okay. Did you just want to write the book on your own initiative, or were you asked?
A little mixture of all of that, really. Lynn, if I seem to recall, and I could be doing her a hideous injustice here, suggested that such a book would be welcome in the sense that it would obviously help draw attention to the situation with the house in perhaps a way that the trust on its own couldn't manage. But I also had people who had read my last book asking me if I was going to look at Undershaw next, because it was the next logical progression from where my last book finished. And I kept sort of saying, no, I'm going to take a rest, I'm not going to do it. But everyone kept asking, or at least it felt that way. And then in May of 2010, my second book was shortlisted for the Sherlock Holmes Society of London's annual literary award. And it sort of made my head swell so much that I thought, oh, I'm feeling all positive about everything. But I guess it was the straw that broke the camel's back. And I'm sure Lynn will probably remember, I sent her an email towards the end of May where I basically said, oh, all right, then I'll do it.
And that was fabulous news to receive, Alistair.
You haven't read the book yet.
This sounds like a threat.
I've actually got it here with me in my hands as we speak.
What are you going to do with it?
Well, I was hoping to read, if Alistair permits, or a bit later on when you girls have maybe finished asking questions, just the last paragraph of Mark's fabulous foreword. So it's
you notice she doesn't want to read anything I wrote.
Well, it's because I haven't got that far yet.
There's a smackdown happening right now. Yeah, like, I love that Mark is the patron and that he wrote the foreword and everything. I adore that man. He has such a good heart.
I'm a proper gentleman, I must say.
Lynn, if you want to read the foreword, that would be great.
As long as Alistair doesn't mind. And right, okay, here we go then. The last paragraph of Mark Forward. Many of the extraordinary talents and personalities of the time wander not only through these pages, but through Undershaw itself. This charming book stands not only as a testament to a crucial and hugely productive period in the life of one of our greatest storytellers, but as a proud call to arms for his house's preservation. After all, if Sherlock Holmes could so happily return from the dead, surely Undershaw can too. And that's it.
Yeah, very true indeed.
Very true.
Yeah, it's quite unbelievable when you think about it. Going back to Undershaw as we saw it is, I was thinking even for it might be stupid to say that, but even for a village, for a place, you know, as it is, there is such a brilliant space over there. You know, it's very protected, it's very secular, and you have the house, and there is so much potential for maybe education matters and how taking the kids and telling them about the story of Conan Doyle. The potential for a museum is just so blatantly obvious. You have to wonder why, you know, it's getting so complicated to save the house. You know what I mean? Mm. I find it really, really sad. I know there are more stuff at stake, including financial issues, but it is, you know, we want to save literature heroes. We want to save all this stuff, and it should matter more than that. And that's why I find it really, really sad. Yeah, the house was just in a terrible state when I saw it, and it was heartbreaking. So I really hope people are get more and more interested in it. So yeah, still think about it, and it was really sad. So yeah, sorry, I just had to say my part.
Yeah, very, very well said as well, Marie. You know, I totally agree with you, and you know, it's been a hard fight. I mean, it's not been easy. You know, there's days when I'm stressed. You know, sometimes I can actually cry over, you know, somebody could probably be against the saving of bricks and mortar and where we're working so hard to try and save it. But what spurred us on really is the fabulous support that has grown since we started out. It's just been fabulous, the emails we get. I mean, like yesterday I received an email from an Australian lady, and you know, obviously when I receive these emails, I don't always look at them and think, oh my gosh, you know, this person wants to save Undershaw. You know, I do take them and look at them very seriously, because out there could be some jokers who think that they can write and sort of make a joke of it. And this lady certainly wants to do something about it, and has asked whether I could give her the telephone number to the developers. But obviously I do have to refrain myself from just dishing out telephone numbers, as you're fully aware, especially with the judicial review looming.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to answer sort of or find out a bit more about the person, because, you know, it could just be a hoax. Somebody could be just tapping in and thinking, well, come on, let's have a bit of a joke. So I do take them seriously, and but this one sort of has given me a little bit of interest and hope, I suppose, really. It's Waverley Borough Council are just not budging, and when you hear things like that, that's when you sort of think, gosh, you know, it's I mean, 6 years people, or John, has certainly been fighting to save Undershaw, and I've only joined him in the last sort of 3 years, so, so it's been a hard slog.
Yeah, I can imagine. And can I ask you something for the people who are listening to the podcast and are not necessarily aware of what's going on? Can you just tell us a bit where the situation stands right now, as in terms of there's a what you call the judicial review coming up, right? What are the dates? What's going on? Like more practical stuff.
You stole my question, Marie.
Sorry. Well, just a few details.
I've saved announcing this particular date for you guys, although I have in confidence told a couple of people, but I have not, or we have not announced it on our website or our Facebook page. So it was kept specially for the babe. So,
we touched.
But basically what happened, I don't know much about the judicial review because obviously John has been dealing with that, and we submitted our papers back in December. 2010, and we've been waiting ever since for a date. The judicial review is very, very difficult for anybody to win, and if we won it, we would probably be first people to ever win against housing developers and against local authorities. So what happens, our case is submitted to a senior judge at the High Court in London, and then it has to be approved by the senior judge. Now, as it happened, it was approved. He thinks that we have got a fairly strong case. Now, a judicial review will only go on planning law. So we could turn round and say to them, well, look, you know, you've allowed this house to get into such disrepair. You're supposed to be, you're the council, it's a Grade 2 listed building. You're supposed to be looking after it. Why haven't you? Why has it fallen into such disrepair? That would not count. It has to be the finer points of planning law. He got in contact with our solicitor several weeks ago. Now, wait for it. The date that we've been given is a date in May. It is the 23rd of May, 2012. Now, what is the date? Twenty-second of May. Does that ring any bells?
Okay.
Does that ring any bells with you guys?
Would you like me to do the honours, Lynn?
Oh,
oh yes, please. Please go.
So I can hear a lot of people desperate to be put out of their miseries here.
Yes,
it will be as near as damn it to the anniversary of Conan Doyle's birth.
Oh wow! Yeah.
It's the 153rd anniversary of his birthday.
Well, that's got to be a sign.
That's karma.
He's working his magic.
Like I'm like sitting here, like my palms are like sweating because I don't understand how Waverley can be so obstinate and just it comes down to greed and wanting money. And it's weird because there's those houses right next to Undershaw that are like multi-million-pound houses. And none of them are selling. I don't understand what they hope to achieve by...
I very much regret to suggest that I think this has come down to more of being a battle of personalities. It's become more of a grudge match, I think. There's almost this kind of we're going to beat you mentality, where the house, all its associations, and even the development prospects have almost become irrelevant next to the we want to win aspect of it.
It's just so
That's
nasty.
How it's like me.
Yeah, I mean, just... You know, interrupting for a few minutes, but on the agent website, or I'm not sure if it's their website or their blog, but they actually put after the planning meeting, which was held in June 2010, we've actually beaten the great detective Sherlock Holmes. So that really, really did grind into John, and he felt then that's when he would go forward with the judicial review to read something like that. So
it's unbelievable though, because it really feels like some kind of, I mean, one would think that in terms of education and stuff, like I was saying just before, we would privilege, you know, the desire to keep something that is so iconic for the British literature and for such an iconic man as well. And one can, you can only wonder why would these guys would find any pride in thinking they would beat you or something.
Exactly.
It's ridiculous. Like, it's like, wow, so that's what it's all about. Like, literally, these people are trying to save something that has to be saved for the sake of future generation. And the only thing you can find to do is just go in with the big trucks and saying, we're going to just kill everything and destroy everything just because we can. I think it's terrible. I think it's absolutely terrible. That's why people need to know about it. That's really why people need to know about it.
I think we have to
keep fighting.
Yes, we will. We will. but Marie and you guys, I mean, it's become a burden to Waverley Borough Council. That's basically why I think they just want to get rid. It's a big burden to them financially.
Mm. Yeah. If anyone out there has an extra, you know, £2 million, why don't you send it over? Okay, it'll be fine. Great.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? There might be someone up there who doesn't know about this situation and who could
well,
be...
Well, this is it. Yeah. This is why, you know, the reps that we've got, and I know two of them are the babes. I think it's just two, yes. Yes, of course, one definitely, but the other one, Christina, hope to meet when you get back to the UK and have a chat.
Yeah, London.
So the bays will be reunited soon.
Yes.
The reps have done a fabulous job with helping with our cause. And I don't know what I would have done without them, really, because certainly they spread the word a lot more to corners of the world that perhaps we would never have got to. So our thanks to them, you know, and, you know, everybody else on our Facebook page that submits their artwork and, you know, letters and whatever, you know, we couldn't do without it. It's just been fabulous.
I read something that, I don't know if Waverley put it out or something, saying that it's not worth to say because Sir Arthur Conan Doyle isn't as prolific as a writer as Jane Austen or Charles Dickens. And I just started laughing. I'm like, are you serious? Do you see what's happening right now? Like, there's Sherlock Holmes everywhere. He's, like, most portrayed character in literature. Their logic just continues to just make me homicidal.
A lot of that has to do with the fact that he's not rated as highly because the vast majority of his work was short stories. And for some reason, it all comes down to novelists rather than short story writers. Mm. It's perverse, I know. It's completely ridiculous when you consider the impact his work has had worldwide. But because he is known first and foremost as a short story writer and also of mostly of crime tales, which are looked down along at sort of very snobbly by people as a subgenre or, you know, a substandard genre, that some people in lofty places have just got a very warped idea of what is and what is not important from a literary standpoint.
Yeah, but it's not even true. I mean, he wrote lots of other things besides Sherlock Holmes. I mean, Brigadier Gerard, anyone? Or The Last World, the Professor Challenger novels?
Right, right. And he wasn't even knighted,
you know.
Sherlock Holmes.
All very true, but they just don't have the fame. At the end of the day, it's not so much what he's written, but what he's known for and how that is perceived. And these people are too blinkered. They don't see that huge body of work. They don't see all the sort of the fantastic commentaries on the Boer War and the First World War and all that. It's very easy to pigeonhole Conan Doyle by saying that he was a fairy-obsessed writer of crime stories. It's, you know, far too many people judge him on what he did in, like, the last sort of 15 years of his life. They look at the man that thought fairies were real and just use that as an excuse to put him in a box and forget about it.
Or ACD. And he was pigeonholed so much even when he was writing, and that's why he'd wanted to kill Sherlock Holmes, because he hated him so much. And we see how well that worked out, but...
Well, again, the people brought it back in a way, so we can only hope the people are going to do the same for Undershow, you know?
So. Conan Doyle never actually killed Holmes, so that's the funny thing.
Yeah, he tried.
He could have so easily described a body being washed up at the bottom of the falls, mm-hmm. but he never did. He left the door open. He wasn't forced to do a Bobby Ewing stepping out of the shower moment. You know, it was very easy for him to bring Holmes back because the body was never there. You know, he left the conclusion to Watson, and Watson was famous for getting it wrong.
Poor Watson.
He has Watson tell us that they must both be resting or fighting together at the bottom of the falls for all eternity. And he was so clearly giving himself the option to bring him back that it screams at you today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Oh, easy. Oh, well.
Damn you, ACD. But yeah, I think we can never stop talking about Undershow enough, because I think this is the only way we can bring more attention. It's really, like you said, it's really nice to see how it spread around the world, which was quite interesting. Mm. And I think Sherlock Holmes is really coming back into fashion. I mean, we have the movies, we have the TV show, we have a Russian TV show that is being made at the moment. I heard the American are going back with the TV show.
We don't talk about that.
We don't talk about that, but you never know, you know, what it can create in fans.
I just heard something last night that America is creating a television show about Arthur Conan Doyle and Harry Houdini solving crime together with a female cop in the 1920s.
What?
This is all true.
Oh, that is absurd.
That oh my could God. Be so much fun.
It's gonna be ridiculous.
Well,
they
it depends.
Each other by then.
It's like,
I mean,
God.
Surely a show like that cannot take itself seriously. So you wouldn't be expected to take it seriously either. So I'd say it could be hilarious fun.
It really depends which channel is going to do it, I have to say. I'm not going to name names, but depending on who does it, it could go really wrong. So, yeah, let's wait and see.
Yeah, so that's happening.
That's exactly what we could do with. It is a TV documentary on Doyle's time at Undershow and the efforts that have gone in to save it. I mean, I've been researching it ever since I've taken this on. That in itself has been hard work trying to convince various people about it. And in fact, last year I did meet with the London ITV news reporter, mm-hmm. who was also a TV documentary. Yeah, she also made TV documentary, and she was very interested in putting something together. But she did tell me that it would cost quite a bit to get it commissioned, and who would commission it, and it probably would actually make its way over to the States first of all, and probably then make its way back here, which I mean wasn't a problem. And so I'm still pursuing it. We have actually got and I think I've mentioned it on Facebook before, apparently an unseen footage of Conan Doyle in the grounds of Windlesham with his children, with his wife actually doing the narrating, and he was playing with his children. It's about a 20-minute footage. I know it's not Undershow, but it could be combined into the documentary, you know, and it's just something that I think if we could get something off the ground, I mean, even with Alistair's book, if a documentary could be made from that, I just think it would also promote the cause.
Mm.
I mean, we definitely need something big like that to be put out there. It's just finding the right people.
Yeah, that's generally what kickstarts a few things around as well, because I think people get more interested when they have a rather big visual explanation of everything. Documentary are really good for that. I mean, it works before, but it's true. It's really expensive to make, and also you need to find the right sponsors. You need to find everything. I mean, I've been there before in my job, so I know how it feels. But yeah, I mean, that would be a fantastic idea. I mean, it's probably worth bringing it back maybe and see what's going on. Talk about it. Who knows? On the Baker Street Babe page.
I think it's also important to Undershow, like, architecturally, it's very unique, and it's a great example of Victorian architecture. So it has that going for it as well. Like, it was designed by Arthur Conan Doyle, That's amazing in itself.
There's so much history within its walls.
Aren't there paintings of some of the stories inside of the house? Or am I making that up?
In a shed, I suppose, in the ground.
Uh-huh.
And you can't see it now. The bushes have overgrown and everything. Within a little blue shack, there are paintings of all of, or most of, Conan Doyle's book all around the seating area. I don't know whether that's what you meant.
Yeah, I know there was some.
So, and I think that was sort of obviously put there when it was a hotel for people to go up a few steps and into the sort of bushes and have their meal. So, and engraved in woodwork, there is Sherlock Holmes's sort of pipe and his hat and his face. So like the silhouette on back of one of the seats. And believe it or not, the interior of the house is not as bad as one would feel. You know, it can be restored, even in its derelict state. Obviously, the professionals. I mean, I don't know whether anybody's aware, but we do have somebody who answered a one of our features in the Telegraph. I think it was back in the end of 2009. I think it was Christmas 2009. We had a little article appear in the Telegraph. And that was answered by a gentleman from Devon who currently owns the Coleridge estate down there, three times the size of Undershaw, and he put in a planning application. I think you guys probably already know, put in a planning application the same time and was received in Waverley Borough Council the same time as the developer's application. But unfortunately, during the planning meeting, it was actually mentioned, but not in great detail.
Of course.
So it was just pushed to one side. And that was after he had sought advice from Waverley Borough Council, paid them a certain set of money to go forward with the planning application to restore Undershaw as a single dwelling. Restore it like for like as Conan Doyle would have had it.
Wow, that is just terrible.
Open it to the public several times a year and have it as his family home. And Waverley Borough Council just did not want to know.
I don't even know what to say.
Yeah, me neither. I'm like, yeah. You gotta be kidding me.
Yeah.
I believe he's hanging on.
Very good.
Well, his plans are still with Waverley Borough Council, so he has to hang on. I mean, he's paid all this money to submit the plan.
Yeah.
So I don't think he's going to back out until obviously after the judicial review, and obviously we need to see what that will bring up. But
of course,
you know, it's not going to be easy, guys. Mm-hmm. And I hope you're all going to be available to come along and support it. You know, because obviously I believe the court will take in people. I think it's got seats for about 100. So we need supporters there on the day of the judicial review.
For sure.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, God, I'm like, I'm getting so angry.
It's like all this angst building. It's just like that.
I wonder how many other people are getting angry.
Because I just don't understand anyone who can, and like Alistair said, it's just sort of now just like a pissing contest. It's like, we're going against you just so we can win, and they're not thinking about the ramifications or the impact that it, if what they do happens. Rawr. Very eloquent rawr.
I personally think, I mean, I've recently written something on Facebook, which I read in the Grey Shot newsletter, that businesses, small businesses within the small villages surrounding obviously Hindhead, Hazelmere, Grey Shot, since the new tunnel has opened, businesses have obviously suffered. And we just feel, with the regeneration of Hindhead, as Alistair hit on, that it could bring in so much financially for those businesses. And I'm sure that, you know, businesses would pick up if we had something within the area that would attract tourists. And the only thing that I can think of would be Undershaw. But there you go. I really don't know what they're thinking.
They're probably not thinking, yeah, that's the story.
Well, yeah.
So, Alistair, your book comes out in December? Are you doing any sort of press or going around talking about it anywhere?
I'm not aware of any plans for me to do that. I'm sure my publisher will throw everything at me he thinks I can do when, nearer the time. I would contest that this counts.
Yes, for sure.
Definitely.
The only thing in my calendar, and that's not for about 6 months, but Lynn's aware of this, that in roughly mid-June, Hazelmere have a festival, and I will be talking at an event at that festival to introduce a screening of Hammer's version of Hound of the Baskervilles, and I'll be using my preliminary talk to sort of give a rundown of Arthur Conan Doyle's connection to the area. I mean, it won't be, as it were, a pitch for the Undershore Preservation Trust, because that's not the purpose of the platform, and I don't think I'd be very well received if I started ranting about it. But I will certainly draw everyone's attention, if they're not already aware, to the connections between Conan Doyle and the area, and take the opportunity to get the book out there, and then hopefully people can take that away and from that get an idea of what the Trust is trying to achieve. As for any other events that might come up between now and then, who knows?
You know what we should do? We should rent one of those planes that has like the tail that you can write a message on. And just like say Undershawn is flying around London and everything. This is a good plan. Does anyone have a plane?
Actually, I think that, what is it? Is it the premiere for the next Sherlock movies next week, right? I can just go there with a giant banner saying Undershaw and try to get in any media I can see.
Oh my god, please do that. It's like jump in front of cameras.
That could actually be very funny.
Yeah.
And then after that, I'm going to have to hide for a long time. So I don't know. I have to think about it.
But we've got some spare banners here, Marie, if you want them.
I see that you like that idea. Thank you very much.
Yes, I love it. In fact, the idea I did love is what you mentioned when I met you back in May.
Ooh, I know what you're going to talk about. Yeah.
The Trafalgar Square.
A freeze. Yeah. A flash mob.
Yes.
When I get back to London, we need to do that.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah, I'm fine. I can organize a flash mob.
Because there are.
Started.
There's so many Sherlock Holmes fans in London alone, in the surrounding area, that we could get a ton of people. And it's like a lot of people, like, unfortunately, still don't know about Undershaw, but if you tell them, immediately everyone's like, oh my god, yes, I will help. And if you just got a lot of people, it would be great. And Trafalgar Square is the perfect place to do that.
So what you don't know now is that as soon as we're going to publish the podcast, it's going to be known everywhere. And then suddenly we're going to have random flash mobs about Undershaw. It's going to be brilliant.
That would absolutely be fabulous. And especially if it's before the judicial review as well.
Oh, yeah. We have to get, like, prime tourist seasons. When does that start? Like, in the spring?
Oh, yeah. We'll find
just
a way.
Just keep doing them, like, all the time.
Just every time you pass back Trafalgar Square, you just stand in the middle, not moving, the Undershaw banner for 10 minutes. That's in our days now, we call that performance art, so that should work. No, that
sounds
should work.
Fabulous.
It's going to happen. Yeah, yes.
We have to think about this. We have to think about this.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, like, any PR becomes good PR. And it's like just getting the name out there, because if someone just sees it even passing by, it may stick in their head and they're like, oh, let me Google that. And then voila, it's really all it takes. And then they'll research more about it and then they'll get really angry like I am right now.
Yeah, not difficult to be angry.
No.
Well, of course, all the best research can be found in a certain book that will be out in 2 weeks' time.
Exactly. Oh.
That was a good plug, Alistair.
That was very smooth.
So yeah, let's talk a little bit more about it, because I feel bad that we haven't touched so much about it. But it's called An Entirely New Country.
That's correct.
Conan Doyle, Undershaw, and the Resurrection of Sherlock Holmes. So I don't just want to...
Short and punchy.
Indeed. So, I don't know, do you just want to give, like, a general synopsis, sort of summary?
Well, the basic gist of it is just the life and times of Conan Doyle during the years he lived in the house. So, it's basically that 10-year period of his life from the tail end of 1896 into the middle to end of 1907. So, it's not about the house as a physical object. It's about what went on when he was a resident. So, a lot of elements of the book will take place a long way away from Undershaw. But I'm trying to sort of give you a snapshot of his life using the house as an anchor, a chronological anchor, if you will.
For sure.
So it sort of opens with him returning to England after taking his wife to Switzerland for her health. Then it goes all the way through to the arrival of Sherlock Holmes on the stage, Conan Doyle's service in the Boer War, his attempts at standing for Parliament, and then right through to the death of his first wife, marrying his second, and ultimately leaving Undershaw. So that entire 10-year period with all the things that went on in it is covered, basically. And because I'm only covering those 10 years, I can go in a little bit more depth, a little bit more focus than a regular biography. I heard an American chap I know describe many biographies as womb to tomb. and this isn't one of those. I mean, if you try and do Conan Doyle's whole life, which is like 71 years, you've inevitably got to skim certain parts, otherwise you end up with a book, you know, 10,000 pages long. With my book, because I'm only looking at 10 years, I can delve far deeper, I can focus, I can concentrate, and you don't end up with a book that's too sort of imposing. So that's the idea. It's to give people a good, handy snapshot of that 10-year period to try and illustrate exactly what went on when he was living in those four walls.
What did you do research-wise?
Well, the way I kicked it off, really, was obviously to start with the books I already owned by other authors to see what, if anything, they had covered of those years.
Mm-hmm.
Then you see where there are gaps, for example, areas where they didn't dwell on too much. You may have heard, or I mean, of course you will have heard, of Andrew Lysett's biography of Conan Doyle that came out in 2007. He, mm-hmm. for example, wrote precious little about the William Gillette play that went on during those years. He sort of covered its conception and its debut in about two or three paragraphs, but then again he kind of had to because of the scope of his book. I was able to cover it from its very first conception right through to the discussions between Gillette and Conan Doyle about what it would contain, right through to its American debut, then its British debut and its reception, and right through to when Gillette was still sort of reviving it 5, 6, 7 years later. So that's an example of how I've been able to focus in a bit more. But where I started most of my research was with the internet, and I know everyone's going to jump up and down and scream Wikipedia or something like that, but fortunately it wasn't. There are a lot of British newspapers who now have digitized archives available online, and it's very simple. You sort of log on to one of these, you buy a credit, you say, right, 1897 to 1907 Conan Doyle, go, and it says, oh, we have found 25,000 results or something like that. And you start at one end and work your way forward, and you do that with every newspaper of the day, and you just unearth all kinds of odd little gems, and then some of them you ignore because they seem irrelevant, others look intriguing, you dig deeper, and that's what I did.
How long did that take you?
Well, I mean, I put finishing touches to it only about 2 or 3 months ago, and I started it in May 2010, so about a year and a half nearly.
Okay. The internet's a great resource for this stuff. For my medieval degree, like, there's like illuminated manuscripts online now, so, I mean, the internet is not a bad place to find research, in the internet's defense.
And it's all due to the work of hardworking librarians everywhere, so can we take a moment?
Thank you, Artie.
I did have to rely on libraries as well, of course, so I liaised with many of the libraries and photographic centres in and around that area. So there were museums in Farnham, in Hazelmere and such like who I contacted, to some of whom sent me clippings and you know, cuttings of various things in their own collections, particularly local newspapers. There was also a book actually that was co-edited by John Gibson, which is entitled Letters to the Press, which consists of every sort of letter that Conan Doyle ever wrote to the media, both within the UK and abroad. So many of those letters, particularly on the Boer War, for example, that was a good resource. So it's amazing how it covers. And then, of course, you also give yourself a headache staring at microfilm readers in libraries.
Oh, God, microfilm.
Sitting there spinning, hoping that somehow, like Neo in The Matrix, you can spin it really fast and you might still take it all in. Of course, the biggest aspect of the research in terms of being momentous for me was going to meet with Georgina Doyle, who is effectively Conan Doyle's niece-in-law.
She was at A Study in Scandal in Toronto. I got to talk to her a little bit. She's very sweet. So what did you talk to her about?
Well, it was quite funny. When I first phoned her, Lynn got me the number, and I sort of sat by the phone the day I phoned her, as like a nervous schoolboy about to see the headmistress or something. No idea. About to ring Conan Doyle's niece-in-law, to all intents and purposes, terrified the hell out of me. And I remember when she answered the phone, and I was like, "Hello." I just felt terrible. I felt like I was asking all these dumb questions, and it really was. I mean, she didn't know me, so she was a little bit on her guard because I'm just this disembodied voice. But I asked her for permission to sort of use photographs from her book, and it was like, "Oh yes, of course." And it was all sort of quite abrupt, and then we finally arranged for me to go down there, and then she sort of transformed into this motherly figure that kept seeming to think I needed feeding every 5 minutes. Was, "Do you want a biscuit? Do you want another cup of tea? Have you eaten enough?"
That's the most precious story ever.
I was just terrified. I mean, she kept offering me beer, and I thought, no, if I get drunk and I'm looking at your photographs or something, I might end up spilling beer on one. It will never do. No, I'll have water, please. I actually remember it was a very hot day, the first day I went there, and I don't do the heat very well. And I was sat in her room reading a letter she'd handed to me that was written by Conan Doyle's daughter, Jean. And I lifted my thumb off it and realised I'd smudged some of the ink. And this letter was God knows how old, and I thought, like, oh, do I admit to this, or do I put it down somewhere and pretend it didn't happen? And I sort of put it to one side and hope she wouldn't notice.
Well, the word's out now.
Yes, I know. I've done. Well, she's sharp-eyed enough; she will have seen it. So, if she's chosen not to mention it, then I just consider that matter closed. I still got permission to use the photograph, so I can't have done that badly. She is actually responsible for giving me probably the book's only real major coup, which is the architect's drawing of Undershaw as it was envisaged before it was built.
Which I must say is absolutely fabulous. So
I've not seen it in any book.
I'm looking at it now, and it is absolutely fabulous.
What page is it on?
Hello, you got it as well?
I have the PDF.
I've actually got mine signed by Alistair Girls.
Ew.
And his comments are, "Dear Lynn, this is all your fault, you know, Alistair." a very well treasured book.
That's the best sign ever. "This is all your fault."
You have no idea how long it took me to dream that particular gem up. It's a bit like if someone you know is leaving the company you work for, and when the card comes around to sign, you can never think what to say. Whenever you're signing a book, it's exactly the same problem. I didn't want to put "best wishes" and my name, because that's just so boring. Trying to think of something original, and that was the best I could do. I tell you, signing books is not all it's cracked up to be. You do meet some very interesting people in the process.
Ooh, do you have a story? Is there a story in there? What's the craziest person you've met?
Well, I remember I did a book signing for my second book. So going back a bit now, we're going back into 2009, and business has been a little bit slow for a while. And I remember seeing three guys in anoraks, so I think you can see where this is going, walk past the outside of the bookshop, look in, see me sat there, talk amongst themselves, then they vanished. And what I didn't realise was they'd gone into the bookshop by a different entrance, picked up copies of the book, and then suddenly they appeared from nowhere for me to sign them, and they had stereotypically nerdy voices, like a "hello," that sort of thing. this one guy popped up to me and said, "You know, can you sign this?" And I said yes, and then I signed it, and then he put that away and whipped out an autograph book, which I found extremely surreal, because I don't expect to sign one of those. And he sort of opened it up to a nice blank page, so I signed it. I felt incredibly weird, and I thought, you know, I'm not famous, I shouldn't be signing this thing. He took it back, looked at it, smiled, and then said, "You're right after Roger Moore." Then he had to have a photo taken, and then he disappeared. So pages, my picture's probably up there looking very nervous with their arms wrapped around me in the picture. And also when you're signing books, it's very strange. People treat you almost like you're a waxwork. They come right up to you. They come up to you at a distance they would never do in the street. They completely invade your personal space, but they don't talk to you. So I remember this guy came right up to the table where I had a small pile of books in front of me. He was, you know, a foot away from me at best, towering over. He picked up one of my books, read a couple of pages of it, put it back down, sort of patted it, and walked away without exchanging a single word with me. I might as well have been a waxwork, so yeah, it's not all glamour.
On on that note, I suppose you should probably wrap it up.
It's been lovely speaking to you all.
Where can we find you?
Well, it's one of those things I don't like to boast, but if you put my name into Google, just Alistair Duncan space Sherlock, I'm the first one that comes up.
We see what you did here.
Yeah. And Alistair's a very good Twitter buddy. He's always on.
Follow me now if you don't already. Alistair DE221B. I thought I'd go for a rhyme.
And then Lynn.
Right, well, if obviously you just put Undershore in it, that normally comes up as the first one as well, Alistair. But it's
another SmackDown.
So the full address is www.saveundershore.com, and Twitter is SpiritAngel04. And at the moment, I'm not able to follow anybody, which is very, very annoying. So I've had a lots of follows recently, but I can't follow back, I'm afraid, as you've probably seen with my tweet. And I think it's something that Twitter have done or added new to their system. So I've got to have a lot more followers, please.
Yes, please follow Undershaw, because it's really, really important, if you haven't already gotten that from listening to the rest of this.
Can you also mention Facebook earlier?
It is facebook.com/pages/the Undershaw Preservation Trust. Or just type that into the search box and it'll be there. Over 4,000 likes, so.
Christina, damn. Can I just mention, I would like to put a little, I'd like to give somebody a little mention. Am I allowed?
Oh, absolutely.
It's got to be for Caitlin.
Yes, Caitlin. Yep. Because our theme song.
yes, and I hope you're going to get a chance to play it. It's already been played on BBC Radio Surrey, part of it,
mm-hmm.
And I really would like, I mean, basically, we're going to look at this as our anthem, and we hope to get it broadcast on a few more radio shows over here. So if you could give it a plug for us, I'll be grateful. But Caitlin, I just want to say thank you very much, and to everybody basically that have helped. Alistair as well, you know, has done a lot for the campaign. You girls have always and keep mentioning us, so I just really want to say thank you to everybody, and you know, we just need more support, really. You know, please come and join us on our website, Facebook and Twitter, and you know, and what we feel is sort of spurs us on is everybody's comments. You know, it really does give us a boost for what we're trying to achieve. So thank you to everybody for doing that for us.
You're very welcome. And yes, you have Christmas cards out right now that people can
buy. Yeah. What do you think of them? What do you think about the footsteps in the snow?
I think they're lovely. I keep meaning to buy them and then I keep forgetting. So I'm going to do that like right after this.
Yeah, same here.
And then, of course, you can buy Alistair's book and pre-order it.
Thank God for that. I thought I was going to get missed out.
No.
We would never do that.
And I don't know whether anybody knows, but Alistair has very kindly offered 50% of...
50% of the net royalties.
Net royalties. That's, I knew I'd get it wrong. for the book. So that's, you know, another reason why you've got to buy it.
Aw, that's very sweet.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, thank you so much for taking time out of your day.
Marvellous.
Keep up the good work, girls, as well. You know, absolutely amazing. You know, I was going to say it again, 20,000 listeners. Amazing to you. Credit to you, girls. I think it's fabulous.
Yeah, it's insane.
We just need one of those listeners to be a multi-millionaire.
I know.
Yeah. That's the thing.
So hello out there.
There's got to be somebody out there. There's got to be. I can't believe we've all of us have worked so hard on this project, and at the end of the day, we're going to be losing it to Waverley Borough Council. I cannot believe that's going to happen. Watch this space.
Please support Undershaw. Go there. Buy Alistair's book. Be happy. Be merry. Save Undershaw!
I kind of want to go to another show now and just, you know, do a fake commercial, like the Old Spice commercial. you just go like, look at the house, now look at under show. What do you see?
My God, yes. I know, so we have to do Marie's, like, intro as a babe thing.
Oh, God. Yeah. Here goes.
So Marie has been a Big Shoot babe since the beginning, but she was only on episode one doing news time. And so we have to do her formal introduction. She does behind-the-scenes stuff and wada wada, but she will be recording whenever she wants to. So yes. So Marie.
Yes.
The Frenchie, ooh la la.
Oh, God. Not.
So the only thing I know how to say in French is like, voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir?
I actually mentioned that recently on my blog, saying that, you know, it's the kind of thing that people tend to throw at the French people when they're like, ooh, I know where to speak. It's either bonjour, oh là là, or voulez-vous coucher avec moi?
Like, say to people on the street.
It basically goes from a nice hello to let's fuck, which is a bit, you know, slightly offensive. But yeah, by the way, people of the podcast, I'm also known to swear a lot, so get used to it.
Yeah, we have explicit
the one word that Brits know in German is usually blitzkrieg, so, you know, take a pick.
Well, apparently I was considering going for a very stupid French swear word to replace my many attempt at swearing.
Go on.
I was thinking maybe I should just go sacre bleu every time, you know. Whatever. Sacre bleu, which is what I was saying to Christina, is not a French insult. It was created by English speaking people, so it sounds very French. So this is a bit of an insult. So
insultception.
Insultception. Exactly, that's what it is.
By the way, I'd like to say hello to Helene and everyone from Sherlock BBC France forums who are always listening. Yay! You want to say something in French to them? Because, you know.
God, this is always like, do you want to say, it's my first language and I can't speak. bonjour à tous les fans français qui écoutent le podcast. J'espère que vous nous suivez bien depuis 13 épisodes et que vous continuez à bien apprécier tout ce qu'on fait. Et donc, il y a des Français aussi sur le podcast. Voilà.
I have no idea what she said, but voilà.
I said hello to all our French friends, and I said I hope they enjoy the podcast, the 13 episodes so far, and they will keep on following us. That's what I said.
Brilliant. We need to do something special for 17, for the 17 steps. I don't know what it will be. It'll be here before you know it, you know.
We're going fast.
Okay, so yes, Marie, Big Shoot Babe. Okay.
Hmm.
So Marie, how did you get into Sherlock Holmes?
Was that an attempt at doing Sherlock Holmes in French?
Oh no, like Sherlock Holmes.
No. If you want to say it in French, you would say Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, that's not that exciting.
Yeah. That's not really exciting. How did I started with Sherlock Holmes? I started because my dad was a huge Arthur Conan Doyle fan, and when I was a kid, he was basically reading the Sherlock Holmes books and putting it in my hands after reading them. I read all of the Sherlock Holmes books when I was a kid in French, which makes for some interesting confusion when people talk to me about the canon, and I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that in that book, because I can't remember the titles of this kind of stuff and my canon is a bit rusty. But that was my first introduction to it, and I guess also the Disney animated film, which was one of my favorite cartoons when I was a kid.
Yes.
Which in French is called Basile Détective Privé, which has nothing to do with the English name of it. But yeah, I just loved it. I thought it was brilliant. Yeah.
What's your favorite story?
Well, if I have to stick to one, it's a bit cliche, but the Hound of the Baskerville is probably, you know, one of those. It's the one that kind of stick with me later on, and the one I remember the most, even after not reading it for a few years. Yeah, it was very exciting, and it was kind of the quintessential Sherlock Holmes novel, you know, in a way. So yeah, probably the Baskerville.
And your favorite character?
Ha!
I mean, I have no idea.
No, like no one knows who my favorite character is. It's absolutely, completely, totally John Watson. And yeah, it's definitely John Watson. I have a soft spot for what the people call the sidekick, but yeah, always. So John Watson,
till the end of time.
Can I give you a what's a night high five over the
Oh, yes.
There?
Let's just do it. That's done. But yeah, John Watson, definitely.
So, what's your favorite adaptation?
Easy.
Another really
I am absolutely not ashamed to say it's the BBC one. I absolutely love the BBC show. One of the funny thing though is that, you know, as a French, I don't think I've had the chance or the opportunity to see the Granada series and stuff as much as the British people, for example. But I've discovered that later on. But it's true that when I watched the BBC adaptation, I was like, oh, this is just brilliant, because it does take something that feels very familiar to me. And at the same time, it's very close to the original story, and it brings it to a different settings, and it works so well. I think it's brilliant. I've watched the movies. I'm not necessarily a fan of the movies. I enjoy them. Like, they're quite, in a way, for me, again, personal opinion, I think they're quite silly entertainment. It's kind of the Robert Downey Jr. show, which is fine by me. I love him. But, you know, I feel like at the end of the day, it was a bit like we put Robert Downey Jr. in the movie and just say, guy, just do what you want. and that's it's fine. And also Jude Law is fantastic as Watson. But I still think it's more entertainment more than anything else. So I really, really love the BBC version. Voila.
In case you didn't get it before, you can follow Lynn on Twitter at SpiritAngel04 and the Undershaw Preservation Trust at www.saveundershaw.com. You can follow Alistair on Twitter at AlistairD221B, and you can buy his book, An Entirely New Country, and other books by Alistair and other Holmes writers at www.BakerStreetBabesBookshop.com. An Entirely New Country is under Arthur Conan Doyle Books. And as an added treat, we have Caitlin's song for Undershaw, Not Our Glory, for the first time ever on the interwebs. Enjoy!
This room, it don't hold you now like I did. But I can feel your footsteps through the floor. The paper peels away. Don't trail the hallways anymore. And they can't breathe the dust where your feet they graze the ground. If they can't see these memories that keep you around, no, we ain't empty. These silent houses keep the time. Story. 'Cause time may take our lives, but not our glory. These walls could never grow used to the silence, or filtered light run shattered through the glass. Keep the time, the years they wrote a memory. story. This time may take our lives, but not our glory. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to?